Mystery Club. Chapter 31. Chris has his own chair and his own side table, and he now feels like the king of the world. He sometimes forgets the impact a police officer can have on members of the public. The gang in front of him are looking at him with something approaching awe. It's nice to be taken seriously once in a while, and he is happily giving them the benefit of his wisdom. The whole house is wired up with cameras, pretty state-of-the-art stuff too, but we got nothing. On the blink. They often are. Elizabeth is nodding with interest. Anyone you were expecting to see, though?
Any suspects? Asks Elizabeth.
Well, listen, that's not something I can really share, says Chris.
So you do have a suspect?
How wonderful.
What do you make of the coffee and walnut? Says Joyce.
Chris lifts a slice of coffee and walnut cake to his mouth and takes a bite.
Also better than M&S.
Joyce, you wizard.
Also, it was a well-known fact that there were no calories in homemade cakes.
It's delicious, and look, I didn't say we had a suspect, but we have persons of interest, and that's normal.
Persons of interest, says Joyce.
I love it when they say that.
More than one, then, asks Elizabeth.
So not just Ian Ventham?
I suppose you couldn't possibly say.
He couldn't say, you're quite right, says Donna, deciding enough is enough.
Now leave the poor man alone, Elizabeth.
Chris laughs.
I don't think I need protecting here, Donna.
I brought him, turns to Donna.
DCI Hudson is a fine investigator, PC DeFreitas.
You are lucky to have such a good boss.
Oh, he's a pro, agrees Donna.
Elizabeth claps her hands.
Well, it feels like this meeting has been all give and no take.
You've been very kind, Chris.
If I can call you Chris.
Well, I've possibly shared more than I was intending, but I'm glad it's been interesting, says Chris.
It has.
And I think we owe you a favor in return.
You might like to take a look at this.
Elizabeth hands Chris a bright blue binder about a foot thick.
It's a few financials on Ian Ventham.
Details of this place, details of his relationship with Tony Curran.
Probably all nonsense, but I'll let you be the judge.
There is a buzz on Joyce's intercom and she heads off to answer it, while Chris weighs up the binder.
Well, we can certainly take a look through this,
I'll look through it, don't panic, says Donna, and gives Elizabeth a reassuring look.
The door swings open and Joyce walks in with Jason Ritchie himself.
The tattoos, that nose, those forearms.
Mr. Ritchie, says Chris.
We meet at last.
Chapter 32.
Chris had asked Jason if he wouldn't mind stepping outside for a photograph, to make use of the natural light.
Donna is taking the photo.
The two men are smiling happily, arms around each other's shoulders, leaning against a decorative fountain shaped like a dolphin.
Poor Chris, they had really done a number on him.
Donna wonders if Chris truly understands that he's one of the gang now.
It had been useful though.
They had talked to Ron and Jason, and to Joyce, about what they saw.
It had been a row, that much was clear.
None of them could shed a light on what the row was about, but they had all thought it significant, and as Ron and Jason were fighting men, Chris and Donna had listened.
Ron was very proud of his boy, that much was clear.
It was natural, of course, but something to be careful about.
Just in case the photo left by the body hadn't been a red herring.
Donna tells Chris to move to his left a little.
This is very kind of you, Jason, you must have to do it a lot, Chris says, moving to his left a little.
Price of Hua's name, in it, agrees Jason.
Donna has been doing her homework on Jason Ritchie.
Hadn't needed much, to be honest, her dad had been a boxing fan.
Jason has been famous since the late 80s and would now, it seemed, be famous forever.
He had been the hero, sometimes the villain, of a series of iconic fights that captivated the whole country.
Nigel Benn, Chris Eubank, Michael Watson, Steve Collins, and Jason Ritchie. It was boxing as soap opera. Sometimes Jason was J.R. Ewing and other times he was Bobby. The public loved Jason Ritchie. The brawler, the bruiser, tattoos running up and down each arm, long before that was a mandatory requirement for a professional sportsman. He was charming, he was conventionally handsome, becoming more and more unconventionally handsome as his career took its toll. And, of course, he had his famous firebrand dad, Red Ron, always good for a quote. The chat shows loved Jason too. He accidentally knocked out Terry Wogan while showing him how he'd knocked out Steve Collins. Donna had read that that clip still brought him in steady royalties. It never got better than the third Ben v. Ritchie fight. The body slowed a little, the reflexes dulled. This didn't matter while he was still fighting the guys who were aging alongside him, but one by one they started retiring. Jason had found out, many years later, that he'd made less money than the lot of them. Problems with his manager. To this day, a lot of his money was in Estonia. The opponents got younger, the paydays smaller and the training harder, until an Atlantic City night in 1998, fighting a last-minute Venezuelan stand-in, Jason Ritchie hit the canvas for the final time. A few years in the wilderness followed. A few years that were never mentioned in the profiles Donna had read in the papers. A few years where Jason made his money in a very different way. When he was being photographed with Tony Curran and Bobby Tanner. The years that Donna and Chris were interested in. The wilderness years didn't last, though. As a new century dawned, there was almost endless demand for a man who exuded menace and charm in equal parts. From the Lad Mags to the Mockney film directors to the reality shows and the adverts for gambling companies, Jason started making more money than he ever had in the ring. He came third in I'm a Celebrity, he dated Alice Watts from EastEnders, he starred in a film alongside John Travolta as a washed-up fighter and one alongside Scarlett Johansson, also as a washed-up fighter. This new career fairly quickly followed the same trajectory as his boxing career, however. You only had so many days top of the bill. These days there were no films, fewer adverts, and you'd see him turning up on all sorts of things. But no matter, Jason Ritchie was now famous forever and he appears to be grateful too. His smile, in front of the fountain shaped like a dolphin, seems, to Donna, entirely genuine. Donna puts down the big blue file Elizabeth has given her and holds up her phone for the photo. Say cheese, or whatever two men are comfortable saying. Jason starts, I duck and I dive, and then Chris joins him for the shouted, and I always survive. The two men both instinctively punch the air with their free arm and Donna takes the photo. That was his catchphrase, Chris explains to Donna. I duck and I dive and I always survive. Donna pockets her phone. Everyone always survives until they die. It's meaningless. She thought of adding that Rodolfo Mendoza had knocked Jason out in the third round on the East Coast, so he hadn't exactly survived then. But why upset two middle-aged men unnecessarily? They'll love that at Fairhaven, Jason, thanks, mate. No problem. Hope the old man was useful. Donna knows Chris will never show the photo to any of his colleagues. He already has a much more interesting photograph of Jason Ritchie. Very useful, says Chris. Anyway, what's your thinking, Jason? About Tony Curran? You must have known him a bit, from around Fairhaven. A bit, yeah. I knew of him. Not really, though. He had plenty of enemies. Chris nods, then steals a glance at Donna. Donna steps up and offers Jason her hand. Thank you so much, Mr. Ritchie, she says. Jason shakes Donna's hand, my pleasure. Could you send me a copy of the photo? It looked a nice one. Jason writes down his number for Donna. I'll head back up and see Pops. Before you head up, says Donna, taking Jason's number. You knew Tony Curran a little better than you've suggested, didn't you, Jason? Tony Curran? Nah. Seen him in the pub, know people who know him. Heard gossip. You ever drink in the Black Bridge, Jason? Asks Chris. Jason misses just the slightest beat, as if a punch has slipped through, but won't again.
Near the station?
Once or twice.
Years ago.
20-odd years, I'm guessing, says Donna.
Maybe, nods Jason.
Who remembers, though?
You had no dealings with Tony Curran back then, asks Chris.
Jason shrugs, if I remember something I'll tell you.
I'll get up to Dad, nice to meet you both.
I saw a photo recently, Jason, says Chris.
Group of friends in the Black Bridge.
Bobby Tanner, Tony Curran.
Nice one of you.
All very friendly.
Lot of weirdos ask me for photos, mate, says Jason.
No offense.
You'd recognize it?
Table covered in money.
You don't have a copy of it, by any chance, asks Chris.
Jason smiles.
Never seen it?
You wouldn't know who took it, asks Donna.
A photo I've never seen?
Nope.
And we're having trouble tracking down Bobby Tanner, Jason, says Chris.
I don't suppose you know where he is these days.
Jason Ritchie purses his lips for the briefest of moments, then shakes his head, turns and waves over his shoulder as he goes back inside to join his dad.
Chris and Donna watch as the automatic doors slide shut behind him.
Chris looks at his watch then motions towards the car.
He walks and Donna walks alongside him, a smile on her lips.
That entire conversation was the most cockney I've ever heard you sound, sir.
Guilty, admits Chris, finally pronouncing a T.
Why does Jason want a copy of that photo of us?
What's that?
To blackmail me if he ever needs to.
Simpler than that, sir, says Donna.
It's to get my number.
Classic move.
Either way, says Chris.
Don't worry, says Donna.
He won't be getting the photo, or my number.
Good looking fella, says Chris.
He's like 46 or something, says Donna.
No thanks.
Chris nods.
Heaven forbid.
You'd have to say he didn't look too worried, though.
But he's definitely lying about not knowing Tony Curran.
Could be lots of reasons, says Donna.
Could be, agrees Chris.
Hearing footsteps behind them, they turn to see Elizabeth and Joyce hurrying after them.
Joyce has a Tupperware container with her.
I forgot to give you this, says Joyce, handing over her Tupperware.
It's the last of the lemon drizzle.
I'm afraid the coffee and walnut already has someone else's name on it.
Chris takes the cake.
Thank you, Joyce, that will go to a good home.
And Donna, says Elizabeth, gesturing to the blue file.
Do call me if your bedtime reading gets complicated.
Thank you, Elizabeth, says Donna.
I'm sure I'll struggle through.
Here, you should probably have my number too, says Elizabeth, and hands Chris her card.
We'll have lots to chat about in the weeks ahead.
Thank you for coming to see us, we do love visitors.
Donna smiles as Chris virtually bows to Elizabeth and Joyce.
It really was an education, says Joyce, with a smile.
And you should probably let Donna drive, D.C.I. Hudson.
There was an awful lot of vodka in those cakes.
Chapter 33.
Elizabeth had come straight over to Willow's after meeting with the police. She makes sure that Penny has a wash and a set once a week.
Anthony, the hairdresser, comes to Willow's at the end of his appointments and always insists on doing it for free.
One day, if Anthony ever gets into any sort of trouble, or ever needs help, he will discover how grateful Elizabeth is for this kindness.
Mafia, I heard, says Anthony, gently running a soaped sponge through Penny's hair.
Tony Curran owed them money, so they cut off his fingers and killed him.
That's an interesting theory, says Elizabeth.
She has a hand cupped under Penny's neck and lifts her head.
And how did the mafia get into the house?
Shot their way in, I suppose, says Anthony.
Without leaving bullet holes, asks Elizabeth.
Penny's shampoo smells of rose and jasmine and Elizabeth buys it at the shop on site. They stopped selling it for a while, but Elizabeth paid them a visit and they changed their mind.
"Well, that's the mafia for you, Elizabeth," says Anthony.
And without tripping any alarms, "Anthony," says John Gray, from his usual chair.
"Have you seen Goodfellas, John?" says Anthony.
"If that's a film, then I won't have," says John.
"There you are then," says Anthony.
He is now combing Penny's hair.
"You're going to need a little trim next week, Penny darling. Get your disco ready."
"No bullet holes, Anthony," says Elizabeth.
"No alarms, nothing broken, no sign of a struggle.
What does that suggest to you?"
"Triads."
Anthony is unplugging his curling tongs.
"One of these days I'm going to unplug you by mistake, Penny."
"As Penny would be the first to tell you," says Elizabeth.
"It suggests that he let his killer in.
So it must have been someone he knew."
"Oh, I love that," says Anthony.
"Someone he knew."
"Of course."
"You ever killed someone, Elizabeth?"
Elizabeth shrugs.
"I can just picture it," says Anthony, putting on his jacket.
"There you go, Penny.
I'd kiss you, but not with John in the room.
Look at those forearms."
Elizabeth stands and hugs him.
"Thank you, darling."
"She looks gorgeous," says Anthony.
"If I say so myself."
"See you next week, Elizabeth."
"Bye, Penny, bye, handsome John."
"Obliged, Anthony," says John.
As Anthony leaves, Elizabeth sits by Penny again.
"Here's another thing though, Pen. They took young Jason out for a photo afterwards.
I know he gets that a lot, but something didn't seem right.
It felt off."
"Why go outside?"
"Joyce has one of those big picture windows.
You know, the ones in Wordsworth?
That would be a lovely photo."
Mentioning Joyce again.
"Easier every time.
Do you think they were asking Jason about something?
Are we missing something?
We passed him on the stairs coming back up and he was his usual charming self, but who knows?"
Elizabeth sips some water and feels grateful.
Then feels guilty for feeling grateful.
Then feels weak for feeling guilty.
So she carries on talking to Penny.
To Penny, or to herself.
Who knew?
Perhaps it wasn't Ventham at all?
Perhaps we're just being blinded by what's in that file?
By the 12 million.
I mean, where was he when Curran was killed?
Do we even know?
Could he have done it?
Do the timings work?
Elizabeth, forgive me, says John.
But have you ever watched Escape to the Country?
Elizabeth is still not really used to John speaking, but he does seem to be coming out of his shell recently.
I don't believe I have, John, no.
John is fidgeting a little.
Something is clearly on his mind.
I mean, it's rather good.
I'm sure it's nonsense, but even so.
There will be a couple on and they will be looking for a new home.
In the country, John.
In the country, as you say.
And a chap, well sometimes it's a woman, will show them around some houses.
I watch it with the sound down, because it's not really Penny's sort of thing.
You can really see in the eyes of the couple which one wants to move and which one is just going along with it.
For a quiet life, you know.
John, says Elizabeth, leaning forward and staring straight into his eyes.
I've never known you utter a sentence without a reason.
Where is this heading?
Well, it's only heading here, I suppose, says John.
I was watching Escape to the Country, you see, on the day that Curran was killed and they just got to the end, where they decide whether to buy the house or not.
They never do, but that's half the fun.
I got up and wandered out to get a Lacoste Sport from the machine and I looked out of the window, the one at the front, and saw Ventham's car driving off.
The Range Rover, asks Elizabeth.
Yes, the Range Rover, says John.
Coming down the track from the top of the hill.
and I just thought I would mention it to you, as Escape to the Country is on straight after Doctors and it finishes at 3 on the dot.
I see, says Elizabeth. And I thought that perhaps if you knew exactly when Ventham left Cooper's Chase and you knew exactly when Curran had been killed, it might be useful?
For the investigation.
3 p.m., asks Elizabeth.
On the dot.
Thank you, John. I think I need to send a text message.
Elizabeth takes out her phone.
I don't think you're supposed to use your mobile telephone in here, Elizabeth, says John.
Elizabeth gives a kindly shrug.
Well, imagine if we only ever did what we were supposed to, John.
You have a point there, Elizabeth, agrees John, and goes back to his book.
Chapter 34. Donna is getting ready to go out when her phone pings. A message from Elizabeth. She only left her a few hours ago.
It will be trouble, for sure, but she likes seeing the name pop up.
What time was Tony Curran killed?
Well, that was short and to the point.
Donna smiles and composes a reply.
Maybe ask how I am, share a bit of gossip, before asking for a favor?
And sign off with a kiss.
Soften me up a bit. Donna sees the speech bubble, showing that Elizabeth is replying.
She is taking her time, so what will it be?
A lecture?
A reminder of why Donna is investigating a murder, instead of measuring the depth of tire treads in the car park at Halford's, which is what Mark was doing today.
Perhaps it would be something in Latin?
There is a ping.
How are you, Donna?
Mary Lennox has just had a new great-granddaughter, but she is worried that her granddaughter has been having an affair, because the husband has a very prominent chin and it is nowhere to be seen.
What time was Tony Curran killed?
Donna is choosing between lipsticks.
She wants something that doesn't look too obvious, while at the same time looking obvious.
She replies.
I can't tell you that.
I'm a professional.
There is an immediate ping back.
LOL.
LOL.
Where had Elizabeth got that from?
Two can play at that game.
WTF.
This has clearly foxed Elizabeth and Donna has time to look in the mirror and check her interested face, her laughing face and her quietly seductive face before the next ping.
I'm afraid I don't know WTF.
I only discovered LOL from Joyce last week.
I'm going to assume that it doesn't refer to the Warsaw Transit Facility, as that was shut down in 1981 when the Russians came sniffing.
Donna sends back an emoji of big eyes and an emoji of the Russian flag and then starts to floss.
Even though they say you don't need to floss anymore.
Ping.
That's the Chinese flag, Donna.
Just let me know the time of death.
You know we won't tell a soul and you also know we might just come up with something useful.
Donna smiles.
What harm could it do, really?
3.32.
His Fitbit broke when he fell.
There is another ping.
Well, I don't know what a Fitbit is either, but thank you.
Chapter 35.
Joyce, the police came over today and at first I had to feel sorry for DCI Hudson, but I think he rather enjoyed himself by the end.
Anyway, Elizabeth gave him and Donna the file, so we'll see what they make of it.
Joanna's name is not on the file anywhere, which Elizabeth reassured me helps with plausible deniability just in case anything we're doing is against the law.
Which I assume it is.
I asked Elizabeth to repeat the phrase plausible deniability and I wrote it down.
She asked me why I was writing it down and I said it was because I'm writing a diary and she rolled her eyes.
Though she then asked if she was in the diary and I said of course she was and she then asked if I was using her real name.
Which I said I was, though I've thought about it since and who knows with Elizabeth.
Perhaps she's really a Jacqueline?
We tend to accept what people tell us they're called.
No questions asked.
But I've been thinking.
You must think I'm murder obsessed, it's all I've written about since I started this diary.
So perhaps I should tell you some other things.
Let's talk about a few things that aren't murder.
What can I tell you? When I was putting the Hoover round after the police had gone, Elizabeth said she thought I would get on with a Dyson. But I said I didn't think so, not at my age. But perhaps I should take the plunge. And after the hoovering we had a glass of wine. It was a screw top, but you don't notice these days, do you? It's just as good. When Elizabeth went home, I asked her to give my love to Stephen and she said she would. Then I said they should both come to dinner one night and she said that would be lovely. But all is not right, there. She will tell me when she's ready. What else that isn't murder? Mary Lennox's granddaughter has just had a baby. He's called River, which has raised a few eyebrows, but I rather like it. The woman who works in the shop is getting divorced and they've started stocking chocolate digestives. Karen Playfair, from up on the hill, is coming to give us a Cooper's Chase Breakfast Masterclass talk on computers. The last newsletter said she's coming to give a talk about tablets and that caused some confusion, so they had to print an explanation this week. Apart from that, and the murder, all is peace and quiet. Anyway, I see that it's getting late, so I will wish you a good night. While I have been writing, Elizabeth has sent me a message. We are off on a road trip tomorrow. No idea when and no idea why, but I shall look forward to it very much. Chapter 36. Donna can't believe she is already in bed at 9:45. She had gone on the date because, frankly, it was about time. A man called Gregor had taken her to Ziz's, where he had nibbled at a salad and talked her through his protein shake regime for 90 minutes. At one point Donna had asked him who his favorite author was. For Donna an acceptable answer would be Harlan Coben, Kurt Vonnegut, or any woman. Gregor had sagely replied that he didn't believe in books and that you only learn in this life through having experiences and keeping your mind open. When she then raised the thorny philosophical dilemma of whether you could both keep your mind open and not believe in books, he had replied, "Well, I think you rather prove my point there, Diana," and sipped his water in a manner that suggested great wisdom. Close to tears through boredom, Donna had wondered where Carl was this evening. Donna has recently taken to scrolling through the Instagram feed of her ex-boyfriend and the Instagram feed of his new girlfriend, who appeared to be called Toyota. It has become such a habit now, she will sort of miss it when Carl and Toyota split up. Which they will, because Carl is an idiot and he's not going to keep a hold of a girlfriend with eyebrows that great. Does Donna still love Carl? No. Did she ever, if she's being honest? Probably not, now she's had time to think about it. Does she still feel belittled by his rejection? Yes, that's showing no signs of going away. It's sitting like a stone just under her heart. She had arrested a shoplifter in Fairhaven last week, and when he had struggled, she had brought him down with a baton behind the knees. She was aware she had hit him much harder than she should. Sometimes you just had to hit things. Was it a mistake to get as far away from Carl as she could? To transfer to Fairhaven in a frightened huff? Of course it was a mistake. It was stupid. Donna has always been headstrong, always acted quickly and decisively. Which is a fine quality when you are right, but a liability when you are wrong. It's great to be the fastest runner, but not when you're running in the wrong direction. Meeting the Thursday Murder Club was the first good thing that had happened to Donna in a long time. That and Tony Curran being murdered. Donna had taken a photo of herself and Gregor just after he'd finished his superfood salad. She posted it to Instagram with the caption "This is what you get when you date a personal trainer," and added not one but two wink emojis. The only thing men were ever jealous of was good looks, and Carl wasn't to know that Donna had spent much of the evening surveying the dinner table, idly wondering how she would murder Gregor, if she absolutely had to. She had settled on injecting a dough ball with cyanide. Although she later realized that there was no way she could have got Gregor to eat a carb. Talking of Gregor, she hears the toilet flush. She slips her clothes back on and, as he comes back out of the bathroom, she gives him a peck on the cheek. there is no way she's staying overnight in the room of a 28-year-old man who has two posters on his bedroom wall, one of the Dalai Lama and one of a Ferrari. It is still not 10 p.m. and she wonders if she is allowed to text Chris Hudson and see if he fancies a quick drink. Have a little chat about Elizabeth's file, the bits of it that she had understood. Also, she has finally just watched Narcos on Netflix and wants to discuss it with someone. Gregor had not seen it. Gregor didn't watch television, due to a long reason that Donna had quickly lost interest in. Maybe she should just head home and ring Elizabeth instead. Talk through what she'd read in the folder? Would 10 p.m. be too late? Who knew with that lot? They had lunch at 11:30. So, it's either Chris, her boss, or Elizabeth, her, well what exactly was Elizabeth? The word that came to Donna's mind first was friend, but surely that wasn't right. Chapter 37. Not too late at all, PC de Freitas, says Elizabeth, nearly dropping the phone receiver in the darkness and blindly struggling to switch on the bedside light. I was just watching a Morse. Elizabeth manages to flick the light on, sees the gentle rise and fall of Stephen's ribcage. His faithful heart beating on. And why are you up at this hour, Donna? Donna sneaks a look at her watch. Well, it's 10:15. Sometimes I just stay up this late. Now, Elizabeth, the folder was a bit long and a bit complicated, but I think I got some of it. Excellent, replies Elizabeth. I wanted it to be long and complicated enough for you to need to ring me to talk about it. I see, says Donna. It keeps me involved, you see, and it reminds you that we can be useful. I wouldn't want you to feel like we were interfering, Donna, but at the same time I do want to interfere. Donna smiles. Why don't you take me through it? Well, firstly, just to note, there are documents in that folder that would take you weeks to track down. You'd need warrants and all sorts. Ventham wouldn't let you anywhere near some of them. So, I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but even so. Feel free to let me know how you got hold of them. Ron found them in a skip. Amazing what you can find, a lucky break for us all. Now, do you want the headlines before bed? You want to know why Ian Ventham might have murdered Tony Curran. Donna lies back on her pillow, remembering her mum reading her bedtime stories. She is aware that this shouldn't feel similar, but it does. She assents. Now, Ventham's business is very profitable, very well run. But here's the first headline that's of interest to us. We discover that Tony Curran owns 25% of Cooper's Chase. I see, says Donna. But then we discover that Curran is not a partner in the new company Ventham is using for the Woodlands. The new development? Okay. And? There is an appendix in your folder, 4C, I think. The Woodlands was due to be exactly the same as the rest of Cooper's Chase, 75% Ian Ventham, 25% Tony Curran, until Ventham changed his mind and cut Curran out entirely. Now you know what question to ask next. When did Ventham change his mind? Precisely. Well, Ventham signed the papers to cut Curran out of the deal the day before the consultation meeting. Which was, of course, the day before their mysterious row. And the day before someone murdered Tony Curran. So Curran misses out on the Woodlands, says Donna. What would that have cost him? Millions, says Elizabeth. There are huge projections in the folder. Curran would have been counting on an enormous payday before Ventham cut him out of the deal. That's the news he received from Ian Ventham the day he was murdered. Certainly enough for him to threaten Ventham. Is that your thinking? Asks Donna. So Curran threatens Ventham. Ventham gets scared and kills Curran? Gets his retaliation in first. Exactly. And it would get even worse after the next phase of the development, Hillcrest. That's what our expert says. Hillcrest? Asks Donna. The real golden goose. Buying the farmland on top of the hill. doubling the size of the development.
And when will Hillcrest happen? Asks Donna.
Well, that's a sticking point for Ventham.
He doesn't even own the land yet, says Elizabeth.
It is still owned by the farmer, Gordon Playfair.
This is too complicated for me now, Elizabeth, admits Donna.
Forget Hillcrest for now, and forget Gordon Playfair, they're red herrings.
What that folder tells you are two key things.
Firstly, Ventham double-crossed Tony Curran, on the day Curran died.
Agreed.
And secondly, listen carefully to this, Tony Curran's shares have all reverted to Ian Ventham.
Tony Curran's shares pass back to Ian Ventham.
They do, confirms Elizabeth.
If you want to put a figure on it, something simple to tell Chris Hudson, our expert says Tony Curran's death just earned Ian Ventham around £12.25 million.
Donna gives a low whistle.
Which sounds an awful lot like a motive to me, continues Elizabeth.
So I hope this is helpful.
It is helpful, Elizabeth.
I'll let Chris know.
Chris, is it? Says Elizabeth.
I'll let you get back to sleep now, Elizabeth, sorry for ringing so late.
And I'm grateful for what you've done.
And it's cute you keep saying our expert instead of Joyce's daughter.
Very loyal.
I promise we'll look into it.
Thank you, Donna, and no comment.
When you're over next, I would like you to meet my friend Penny.
Thank you, Elizabeth, I'll look forward to it.
Can I ask why you wanted to know what time Tony Curran died?
Just idle curiosity.
I think Penny will like you very much.
Night, night, dear.
Chapter 38. The morning sun is rising in the Kent sky.
Ibrahim, if you keep driving at 29 miles per hour, this whole exercise will be moot, says Elizabeth, her fingers drumming on the glove box.
And if I crash on a sharp bend, the exercise will also be moot, says Ibrahim, eyes fixed on the road and intending to remain steadfast.
Would anyone like a mini cheddar? Asks Joyce.
Ibrahim was tempted, but he liked to have both hands on the wheel at all times.
10 and 2.
Ron was the only one of them who had a car, but there had still been an argument about who was going to drive.
Joyce hadn't held a license for 30 years and so was out immediately.
Ron had put up a token fight, but Ibrahim knew he had lost his confidence on right-hand turns and would be secretly delighted to be voted down.
Elizabeth put up more spirited opposition, mentioning that she still held a fully valid tank license.
She really could play fast and loose with the Official Secrets Act at times.
But, in the end it all came down to this, Ibrahim was the only one who understood how the sat-nav worked.
It had been Elizabeth's idea, he was happy to grant her that.
They knew, somehow, that Ian Ventham had left Cooper's Chase at exactly 3 p.m. and they knew that Tony Curran had been murdered at 3:32.
Ibrahim had had to explain to everyone what a Fitbit was.
And so here they were, timing the journey in Ron's Daihatsu.
Ibrahim knew they could have just plotted the journey on the sat-nav, but he also knew no one else realized that and he had fancied the drive.
It had been a long time.
So Ibrahim is behind the wheel.
Joyce and Ron are happily sharing their mini cheddars in the back seat. Elizabeth has stopped drumming her fingers and is now texting someone on her phone and everyone had been to the toilet before they left, as per his instructions.
Could Ian Ventham have made it from Cooper's Chase to Tony Curran's house in time to kill him?
If he couldn't, then they were barking up the wrong tree.
They were about to find out.
Chapter 39.
Okay, folks, I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
Another early morning and Chris Hudson's murder squad is assembled, in various stages of dishevelment.
Chris has brought in Krispy Kremes from the garage and they are doing brisk business.
Chris goes through what he'd discovered from the Thursday Murder Club and what Donna had told him about the file, after she'd buzzed on his door at 11 p.m.
They'd talked about it over and over and then watched the first episode of Narcos Season 2 with a bottle of red.
Donna had invited herself over and Chris had wondered if this was just what constables were like in London these days.
You had to hand it to her, she knew how to make a quick impression. Ian Ventham, Tony Curran's business partner, broke some bad news to Curran less than 2 hours before the murder. He was cutting him out of a development that would extend Cooper's Chase, a retirement village out near Roberts Bridge. This would have cost Curran a lot of money, and his death has made Ventham even more money. Over $12 million. The two men were seen having an argument shortly before Curran returned home. Did he threaten Ventham? Did Ventham decide it was better to be safe than sorry and send someone round? We know that Curran was killed at 3:32 last Tuesday, but when did Ventham leave Cooper's Chase that day? Where's this info from? Asks a young Dick, Kate something. Sources, says Chris. Where are we on traffic cameras, Terry? You've got Ventham's reg number. Donna's phone buzzes and she looks down at a message. Good luck at the briefing this morning. Love, Elizabeth X. Donna shakes her head. Got the number, but nothing yet. Still looking, says Terry Hallett, shaven-headed, muscles bulging from underneath a white t-shirt. There's a lot of traffic. It's a fun job. That's why you get donuts, Terry, says Chris. Keep it up. And where are we on our other friend in the photograph, Bobby Tanner? They've talked to the police in Amsterdam, says Kate something. Bobby was working for some scousers there after he did a runner. It didn't end well, as far as we can tell, and no one's heard of him since. No records, no bank details, nothing. We're still asking around, to see if he's come back under a different name, but it was a long time ago, there's not many of the old faces left. It'd be nice to chat to him, rule him out at least. Anyone with anything positive for me? A junior DS puts up her hand. She's been sent over from Brighton and is eating carrot sticks instead of a donut. Yes, DS Grant, says Chris, taking a punt on her name. DS Granger, says DS Granger. So close, thinks Chris. There are too many officers on this team. I've been looking at Tony Curran's phone records. He gets 3 calls on the morning of the murder, all from the same number, doesn't pick them up. A mobile, untraceable, probably a burner. Chris nods. Okay, good work DS Granger, email me everything you've got and get onto the phone company, in case they can help. I know they won't, but one of these days they will. Of course, sir, says DS Granger and treats herself to a carrot baton. Donna's phone buzzes again. We are having a little Thursday murder club road trip, in case there was anything you wanted to pass on? Okay, gang, let's get back to it. Terry, anything from the traffic cams, let me know straight away. Kate, can I team you up with DS Granger and see what you can learn about the phone calls? And keep tracing Bobby Tanner, wherever he is, alive or dead, someone must know. Anyone who feels they've got nothing to do, come and knock at my door and I'll find something boring for you. One way or another, let's get Ventham. There is a final buzz on Donna's phone. P.S., my sources saw Chris buying donuts this morning. You lucky thing. Also, Joyce says hello XX. Chapter 40. Bernard Cottle finishes the code word puzzle in the express and puts his pen back in the pocket of his jacket. It is beautiful up here this morning. On the bench, on the hill. Too beautiful, a cruel trick, played on those not still here to see it. He had seen Joyce and her friends driving off somewhere this morning. How happy they had looked. But, then, Joyce seems to make everyone happy. Bernard knows he has gone too far inside himself. Knows he is out of reach, even to Joyce. Bernard is not going to be saved and he doesn't deserve to be saved. Still, what he wouldn't give to be in that car right now. Looking out at the view, as Joyce nattered away, perhaps picking the loose thread from the cuff of his jacket. But instead he will stay here, on the hill, where he sits every day, and wait for what's to come. Well, I've possibly shared more than I was intending, but I'm glad it's been interesting, says Chris. It has. And I think we owe you a favor in return. You might like to take a look at this. Elizabeth hands Chris a bright blue binder about a foot thick. It's a few financials on Ian Ventham. Details of this place, details of his relationship with Tony Curran. Probably all nonsense, but I'll let you be the judge. There is a buzz on Joyce's intercom and she heads off to answer it, while Chris weighs up the binder. Well, we can certainly take a look through this, I'll look through it, don't panic, says Donna, and gives Elizabeth a reassuring look. The door swings open and Joyce walks in with Jason Ritchie himself. The tattoos, that nose, those forearms. Mr. Ritchie, says Chris. We meet at last. 32 Chris had asked Jason if he wouldn't mind stepping outside for a photograph, to make use of the natural light. Donna is taking the photo. The two men are smiling happily, arms around each other's shoulders, leaning against a decorative fountain shaped like a dolphin. Poor Chris, they had really done a number on him. Donna wonders if Chris truly understands that he's one of the gang now. It had been useful though. They had talked to Ron and Jason, and to Joyce, about what they saw. It had been a row, that much was clear. None of them could shed a light on what the row was about, but they had all thought it significant, and as Ron and Jason were fighting men, Chris and Donna had listened. Ron was very proud of his boy, that much was clear. It was natural, of course, but something to be careful about. Just in case the photo left by the body hadn't been a red herring. Donna tells Chris to move to his left a little. This is very kind of you, Jason. You must have to do it a lot, Chris says, moving to his left a little. Price of Hua's name, in it, agrees Jason. Donna has been doing her homework on Jason Ritchie. Hadn't needed much, to be honest, her dad had been a boxing fan. Jason has been famous since the late 80s and would now, it seemed, be famous forever. He had been the hero, sometimes the villain, of a series of iconic fights that captivated the whole country. Nigel Benn, Chris Eubank, Michael Watson, Steve Collins, and Jason Ritchie. It was boxing as soap opera. Sometimes Jason was J.R. Ewing and other times he was Bobby. The public loved Jason Ritchie. The brawler, the bruiser, tattoos running up and down each arm, long before that was a mandatory requirement for a professional sportsman. He was charming. He was conventionally handsome, becoming more and more unconventionally handsome as his career took its toll. And, of course, he had his famous firebrand dad, Red Ron, always good for a quote. The chat shows love Jason too. He accidentally knocked out Terry Wogan while showing him how he'd knocked out Steve Collins. Donna had read that that clip still brought him in steady royalties. It never got better than the third Ben v. Ritchie fight. The body slowed a little, the reflexes dulled. This didn't matter while he was still fighting the guys who were aging alongside him, but one by one they started retiring. Jason had found out, many years later, that he'd made less money than the lot of them. Problems with his manager. To this day, a lot of his money was in Estonia. The opponents got younger, the paydays smaller and the training harder, until an Atlantic City night in 1998, fighting a last-minute Venezuelan stand-in, Jason Ritchie hit the canvas for the final time. A few years in the wilderness followed. A few years that were never mentioned in the profiles Donna had read in the papers. A few years where Jason made his money in a very different way. When he was being photographed with Tony Curran and Bobby Tanner. The years that Donna and Chris were interested in. The wilderness years didn't last, though. As a new century dawned, there was almost endless demand for a man who exuded menace and charm in equal parts. From the Lad Mags to the Mockney film directors to the reality shows and the adverts for gambling companies, Jason started making more money than he ever had in the ring. He came third in I'm a Celebrity, he dated Alice Watts from EastEnders, he starred in a film alongside John Travolta as a washed-up fighter and one alongside Scarlett Johansson, also as a washed-up fighter. This new career fairly quickly followed the same trajectory as his boxing career, however. You only had so many days top of the bill. These days there were no films, fewer adverts, and you'd see him turning up on all sorts of things. But no matter, Jason Ritchie was now famous forever and he appears to be grateful too. His smile, in front of the fountain shaped like a dolphin, seems, to Donna, entirely genuine. Donna puts down the big blue file Elizabeth has given her and holds up her phone for the photo. Say cheese, or whatever two men are comfortable saying. Jason starts, I duck and I dive, and then Chris joins him for the shouted, and I always survive. The two men both instinctively punch the air with their free arm and Donna takes the photo. That was his catchphrase, Chris explains to Donna. I duck and I dive and I always survive. Donna pockets her phone. Everyone always survives until they die. It's meaningless. She thought of adding that Rodolfo Mendoza had knocked Jason out in the third round on the East Coast, so he hadn't exactly survived then. But why upset two middle-aged men unnecessarily? They'll love that at Fairhaven, Jason, thanks, mate. No problem. Hope the old man was useful. Donna knows Chris will never show the photo to any of his colleagues. He already has a much more interesting photograph of Jason Ritchie. Very useful, says Chris. Anyway, what's your thinking, Jason? About Tony Curran? You must have known him a bit, from around Fairhaven. A bit, yeah. I knew of him. Not really, though. He had plenty of enemies. Chris nods, then steals a glance at Donna. Donna steps up and offers Jason her hand. Thank you so much, Mr. Ritchie, she says. Jason shakes Donna's hand, my pleasure. Could you send me a copy of the photo? It looked a nice one. Jason writes down his number for Donna. I'll head back up and see Pops. Before you head up, says Donna, taking Jason's number. You knew Tony Curran a little better than you've suggested, didn't you, Jason? Tony Curran? Nah. Seen him in the pub, know people who know him. Heard gossip. You ever drink in the Black Bridge, Jason? Asks Chris. Jason misses just the slightest beat, as if a punch has slipped through, but won't again. Near the station? Once or twice. Years ago. 20-odd years, I'm guessing, says Donna. Maybe, nods Jason. Who remembers, though? You had no dealings with Tony Curran back then, asks Chris. Jason shrugs, if I remember something I'll tell you. I'll get up to Dad, nice to meet you both. I saw a photo recently, Jason, says Chris. Group of friends in the Black Bridge. Bobby Tanner, Tony Curran. Nice one of you. All very friendly. Lot of weirdos ask me for photos, mate, says Jason. No offense. You'd recognize it? Table covered in money. You don't have a copy of it, by any chance, asks Chris. Jason smiles. Never seen it? You wouldn't know who took it, asks Donna. A photo I've never seen? Nope. And we're having trouble tracking down Bobby Tanner, Jason, says Chris. I don't suppose you know where he is these days. Jason Ritchie purses his lips for the briefest of moments, then shakes his head, turns and waves over his shoulder as he goes back inside to join his dad. Chris and Donna watch as the automatic doors slide shut behind him. Chris looks at his watch then motions towards the car. He walks and Donna walks alongside him, a smile on her lips. That entire conversation was the most cockney I've ever heard you sound, sir. Guilty, admits Chris, finally pronouncing a T. Why does Jason want a copy of that photo of us? What's that? To blackmail me if he ever needs to. Simpler than that, sir, says Donna. It's to get my number. Classic move. Either way, says Chris. Don't worry, says Donna. He won't be getting the photo, or my number.
Good-looking fella, says Chris.
He's like 46 or something, says Donna.
No thanks.
Chris nods.
Heaven forbid.
You'd have to say he didn't look too worried, though.
But he's definitely lying about not knowing Tony Curran.
Could be lots of reasons, says Donna.
Could be, agrees Chris.
Hearing footsteps behind them, they turn to see Elizabeth and Joyce hurrying after them.
Joyce has a Tupperware container with her.
I forgot to give you this, says Joyce, handing over her Tupperware.
It's the last of the lemon drizzle.
I'm afraid the coffee and walnut already has someone else's name on it.
Chris takes the cake.
Thank you, Joyce, that will go to a good home.
And Donna, says Elizabeth, gesturing to the blue file.
Do call me if your bedtime reading gets complicated.
Thank you, Elizabeth, says Donna.
I'm sure I'll struggle through.
Here, you should probably have my number too, says Elizabeth, and hands Chris her card.
We'll have lots to chat about in the weeks ahead.
Thank you for coming to see us, we do love visitors.
Donna smiles as Chris virtually bows to Elizabeth and Joyce.
It really was an education, says Joyce, with a smile.
And you should probably let Donna drive, D.C.I. Hudson.
There was an awful lot of vodka in those cakes.
33 Elizabeth had come straight over to Willow's after meeting with the police.
She makes sure that Penny has a wash and a set once a week.
Anthony, the hairdresser, comes to Willow's at the end of his appointments and always insists on doing it for free.
One day, if Anthony ever gets into any sort of trouble, or ever needs help, he will discover how grateful Elizabeth is for this kindness.
Mafia, I heard, says Anthony, gently running a soaped sponge through Penny's hair.
Tony Curran owed them money, so they cut off his fingers and killed him.
That's an interesting theory, says Elizabeth.
She has a hand cupped under Penny's neck and lifts her head.
And how did the mafia get into the house?
Shot their way in, I suppose, says Anthony.
Without leaving bullet holes, asks Elizabeth.
Penny's shampoo smells of rose and jasmine and Elizabeth buys it at the shop on site.
They stopped selling it for a while, but Elizabeth paid them a visit and they changed their mind.
Well, that's the mafia for you, Elizabeth, says Anthony.
And without tripping any alarms, Anthony, says John Gray, from his usual chair.
Have you seen Goodfellas, John? Says Anthony.
If that's a film then I won't have, says John.
There you are then, says Anthony.
He is now combing Penny's hair.
You're going to need a little trim next week, Penny darling.
Get your disco ready.
No bullet holes, Anthony, says Elizabeth.
No alarms, nothing broken, no sign of a struggle.
What does that suggest to you?
Triads.
Anthony is unplugging his curling tongs.
One of these days I'm going to unplug you by mistake, Penny.
As Penny would be the first to tell you, says Elizabeth.
It suggests that he let his killer in.
So it must have been someone he knew.
Oh, I love that, says Anthony.
Someone he knew.
Of course.
You ever killed someone, Elizabeth?
Elizabeth shrugs.
I can just picture it, says Anthony, putting on his jacket.
There you go, Penny.
I'd kiss you, but not with John in the room.
Look at those forearms.
Elizabeth stands and hugs him.
Thank you, darling.
She looks gorgeous, says Anthony.
If I say so myself.
See you next week, Elizabeth.
Bye, Penny, bye, handsome John.
Obliged, Anthony, says John.
As Anthony leaves, Elizabeth sits by Penny again.
Here's another thing though, Pen. They took young Jason out for a photo afterwards.
I know he gets that a lot, but something didn't seem right.
It felt off.
Why go outside?
Joyce has one of those big picture windows.
You know, the ones in Wordsworth? That would be a lovely photo. Mentioning Joyce again. Easier every time. Do you think they were asking Jason about something? Are we missing something? We passed him on the stairs coming back up and he was his usual charming self, but who knows? Elizabeth sips some water and feels grateful. Then feels guilty for feeling grateful. Then feels weak for feeling guilty. So she carries on talking to Penny. To Penny, or to herself. Who knew? Perhaps it wasn't Ventham at all? Perhaps we're just being blinded by what's in that file? By the 12 million. I mean, where was he when Curran was killed? Do we even know? Could he have done it? Do the timings work? Elizabeth, forgive me, says John. But have you ever watched Escape to the Country? Elizabeth is still not really used to John speaking, but he does seem to be coming out of his shell recently. I don't believe I have, John, no. John is fidgeting a little. Something is clearly on his mind. I mean, it's rather good. I'm sure it's nonsense, but even so. There will be a couple on and they will be looking for a new home. In the country, John. In the country, as you say. And a chap, well sometimes it's a woman, will show them around some houses. I watch it with the sound down, because it's not really Penny's sort of thing. You can really see in the eyes of the couple which one wants to move and which one is just going along with it. For a quiet life, you know. John, says Elizabeth, leaning forward and staring straight into his eyes. I've never known you utter a sentence without a reason. Where is this heading? Well, it's only heading here, I suppose, says John. I was watching Escape to the Country, you see, on the day that Curran was killed and they just got to the end, where they decide whether to buy the house or not. They never do, but that's half the fun. I got up and wandered out to get a Lacoste Sport from the machine and I looked out of the window, the one at the front, and saw Ventham's car driving off. The Range Rover, asks Elizabeth. Yes, the Range Rover, says John. Coming down the track from the top of the hill. And I just thought I would mention it to you, as Escape to the Country is on straight after Doctors and it finishes at 3 on the dot. I see, says Elizabeth. And I thought that perhaps if you knew exactly when Ventham left Cooper's Chase and you knew exactly when Curran had been killed, it might be useful? For the investigation. 3 p.m., asks Elizabeth. On the dot. Thank you, John. I think I need to send a text message. Elizabeth takes out her phone. I don't think you're supposed to use your mobile telephone in here, Elizabeth, says John. Elizabeth gives a kindly shrug. Well, imagine if we only ever did what we were supposed to, John. You have a point there, Elizabeth, agrees John, and goes back to his book. 34 Donna is getting ready to go out when her phone pings. A message from Elizabeth. She only left her a few hours ago. It will be trouble, for sure, but she likes seeing the name pop up. What time was Tony Curran killed? Well, that was short and to the point. Donna smiles and composes a reply. Maybe ask how I am, share a bit of gossip, before asking for a favor? And sign off with a kiss. Soften me up a bit. X Donna sees the speech bubble, showing that Elizabeth is replying. She is taking her time, so what will it be? A lecture? A reminder of why Donna is investigating a murder, instead of measuring the depth of tire treads in the car park at Halford's, which is what Mark was doing today. Perhaps it would be something in Latin? There is a ping. How are you, Donna? Mary Lennox has just had a new great-granddaughter, but she is worried that her granddaughter has been having an affair, because the husband has a very prominent chin and it is nowhere to be seen. What time was Tony Curran killed? X Donna is choosing between lipsticks. She wants something that doesn't look too obvious, while at the same time looking obvious. She replies. I can't tell you that. I'm a professional. there is an immediate ping back. LOL. LOL. Where had Elizabeth got that from? Two can play at that game. WTF. This has clearly foxed Elizabeth, and Donna has time to look in the mirror and check her interested face, her laughing face and her quietly seductive face before the next ping. I'm afraid I don't know, WTF. I only discovered LOL from Joyce last week. I'm going to assume that it doesn't refer to the Warsaw Transit Facility, as that was shut down in 1981 when the Russians came sniffing. Donna sends back an emoji of big eyes and an emoji of the Russian flag and then starts to floss. Even though they say you don't need to floss anymore. Ping. That's the Chinese flag, Donna. Just let me know the time of death. You know we won't tell a soul, and you also know we might just come up with something useful. Donna smiles. What harm could it do, really? 3.32. His Fitbit broke when he fell. There is another ping. Well, I don't know what a Fitbit is either, but thank you. X35 Joyce, the police came over today and at first I had to feel sorry for DCI Hudson, but I think he rather enjoyed himself by the end. Anyway, Elizabeth gave him and Donna the file, so we'll see what they make of it. Joanna's name is not on the file anywhere, which Elizabeth reassured me helps with plausible deniability just in case anything we're doing is against the law. Which I assume it is. I asked Elizabeth to repeat the phrase plausible deniability and I wrote it down. She asked me why I was writing it down and I said it was because I'm writing a diary, and she rolled her eyes. Though she then asked if she was in the diary and I said of course she was, and she then asked if I was using her real name. Which I said I was, though I've thought about it since and who knows with Elizabeth. Perhaps she's really a Jacqueline? We tend to accept what people tell us they're called. No questions asked. But I've been thinking. You must think I'm murder obsessed, it's all I've written about since I started this diary. So perhaps I should tell you some other things. Let's talk about a few things that aren't murder. What can I tell you? When I was putting the Hoover round after the police had gone, Elizabeth said she thought I would get on with a Dyson. But I said I didn't think so, not at my age. But perhaps I should take the plunge. And after the hoovering we had a glass of wine. It was a screw top, but you don't notice these days, do you? It's just as good. When Elizabeth went home, I asked her to give my love to Stephen and she said she would. Then I said they should both come to dinner one night and she said that would be lovely. But all is not right, there. She will tell me when she's ready. What else that isn't murder? Mary Lennox's granddaughter has just had a baby. He's called River, which has raised a few eyebrows, but I rather like it. The woman who works in the shop is getting divorced and they've started stocking chocolate digestives. Karen Playfair, from up on the hill, is coming to give us a Cooper's Chase Breakfast Masterclass talk on computers. The last newsletter said she's coming to give a talk about tablets and that caused some confusion, so they had to print an explanation this week. Apart from that, and the murder, all is peace and quiet. Anyway, I see that it's getting late, so I will wish you a good night. While I have been writing, Elizabeth has sent me a message. We are off on a road trip tomorrow. No idea when and no idea why, but I shall look forward to it very much. 36 Donna can't believe she is already in bed at 9:45. She had gone on the date because, frankly, it was about time. A man called Gregor had taken her to Ziz's, where he had nibbled at a salad and talked her through his protein shake regime for 90 minutes. At one point Donna had asked him who his favorite author was. For Donna an acceptable answer would be Harlan Coben, Kurt Vonnegut, or any woman. Gregor had sagely replied that he didn't believe in books and that you only learn in this life through having experiences and keeping your mind open. When she then raised the thorny philosophical dilemma of whether you could both keep your mind open and not believe in books, he had replied, "Well, I think you rather prove my point there, Diana," and sipped his water in a manner that suggested great wisdom. Close to tears through boredom, Donna had wondered where Carl was this evening. Donna has recently taken to scrolling through the Instagram feed of her ex-boyfriend and the Instagram feed of his new girlfriend, who appeared to be called Toyota. It has become such a habit now, she will sort of miss it when Carl and Toyota split up. Which they will, because Carl is an idiot and he's not going to keep a hold of a girlfriend with eyebrows that great. Does Donna still love Carl? No. Did she ever, if she's being honest? Probably not, now she's had time to think about it. Does she still feel belittled by his rejection? Yes, that's showing no signs of going away. It's sitting like a stone just under her heart. She had arrested a shoplifter in Fairhaven last week, and when he had struggled, she had brought him down with a baton behind the knees. She was aware she had hit him much harder than she should. Sometimes you just had to hit things. Was it a mistake to get as far away from Carl as she could? To transfer to Fairhaven in a frightened huff? Of course it was a mistake. It was stupid. Donna has always been headstrong, always acted quickly and decisively. Which is a fine quality when you are right, but a liability when you are wrong. It's great to be the fastest runner, but not when you're running in the wrong direction. Meeting the Thursday Murder Club was the first good thing that had happened to Donna in a long time. That and Tony Curran being murdered. Donna had taken a photo of herself and Gregor just after he'd finished his superfood salad. She posted it to Instagram with the caption, "This is what you get when you date a personal trainer," and added not one but two wink emojis. The only thing men were ever jealous of was good looks, and Carl wasn't to know that Donna had spent much of the evening surveying the dinner table, idly wondering how she would murder Gregor, if she absolutely had to. She had settled on injecting a dough ball with cyanide. Although she later realized that there was no way she could have got Gregor to eat a carb. Talking of Gregor, she hears the toilet flush. She slips her clothes back on and, as he comes back out of the bathroom, she gives him a peck on the cheek. There is no way she's staying overnight in the room of a 28-year-old man who has two posters on his bedroom wall, one of the Dalai Lama and one of a Ferrari. It is still not 10 p.m. and she wonders if she is allowed to text Chris Hudson and see if he fancies a quick drink. Have a little chat about Elizabeth's file, the bits of it that she had understood. Also, she has finally just watched Narcos on Netflix and wants to discuss it with someone. Gregor had not seen it. Gregor didn't watch television, due to a long reason that Donna had quickly lost interest in. Maybe she should just head home and ring Elizabeth instead? Talk through what she'd read in the folder? Would 10 p.m. be too late? Who knew with that lot? They had lunch at 11:30. So, it's either Chris, her boss, or Elizabeth, her, well, what exactly was Elizabeth? The word that came to Donna's mind first was friend, but surely that wasn't right. 37 Not too late at all, PC de Freitas, says Elizabeth, nearly dropping the phone receiver in the darkness and blindly struggling to switch on the bedside light. I was just watching a Morse. Elizabeth manages to flick the light on, sees the gentle rise and fall of Stephen's ribcage. His faithful heart beating on. And why are you up at this hour, Donna? Donna sneaks a look at her watch. Well, it's 10:15. Sometimes I just stay up this late. Now, Elizabeth, the folder was a bit long and a bit complicated, but I think I got some of it. Excellent, replies Elizabeth. I wanted it to be long and complicated enough for you to need to ring me to talk about it. I see, says Donna. It keeps me involved, you see, and it reminds you that we can be useful. I wouldn't want you to feel like we were interfering, Donna, but at the same time I do want to interfere. Donna smiles. Why don't you take me through it? Well, firstly, just to note, there are documents in that folder that would take you weeks to track down. You'd need warrants and all sorts. Ventham wouldn't let you anywhere near some of them. So, I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but even so. Feel free to let me know how you got hold of them. Ron found them in a skip. Amazing what you can find, a lucky break for us all. Now, do you want the headlines before bed? You want to know why Ian Ventham might have murdered Tony Curran. Donna lies back on her pillow, remembering her mum reading her bedtime stories. She is aware that this shouldn't feel similar, but it does. She assents. Now, Ventham's business is very profitable, very well run. But here's the first headline that's of interest to us. We discover that Tony Curran owns 25% of Cooper's Chase. I see, says Donna. But then we discover that Curran is not a partner in the new company Ventham is using for the Woodlands. The new development? Okay. And? There is an appendix in your folder, 4C, I think. The Woodlands was due to be exactly the same as the rest of Cooper's Chase, 75% Ian Ventham, 25% Tony Curran, until Ventham changed his mind and cut Curran out entirely. Now you know what question to ask next. When did Ventham change his mind? Precisely. Well, Ventham signed the papers to cut Curran out of the deal the day before the consultation meeting. Which was, of course, the day before their mysterious row. And the day before someone murdered Tony Curran. So Curran misses out on the Woodlands, says Donna. What would that have cost him? Millions, says Elizabeth. There are huge projections in the folder. Curran would have been counting on an enormous payday before Ventham cut him out of the deal. That's the news he received from Ian Ventham the day he was murdered. Certainly enough for him to threaten Ventham. Is that your thinking? Asks Donna. So Curran threatens Ventham. Ventham gets scared and kills Curran? Gets his retaliation in first. Exactly. And it would get even worse after the next phase of the development, Hillcrest. That's what our expert says. Hillcrest? Asks Donna. The real golden goose. Buying the farmland on top of the hill. Doubling the size of the development. And when will Hillcrest happen? Asks Donna. Well, that's a sticking point for Ventham. He doesn't even own the land yet, says Elizabeth. It is still owned by the farmer, Gordon Playfair. This is too complicated for me now, Elizabeth, admits Donna. Forget Hillcrest for now, and forget Gordon Playfair, they're red herrings. What that folder tells you are two key things. Firstly, Ventham double-crossed Tony Curran, on the day Curran died. Agreed. And secondly, listen carefully to this, Tony Curran's shares have all reverted to Ian Ventham. Tony Curran's shares pass back to Ian Ventham. They do, confirms Elizabeth. If you want to put a figure on it, something simple to tell Chris Hudson, our expert says Tony Curran's death just earned Ian Ventham around £12.25 million. Donna gives a low whistle. Which sounds an awful lot like a motive to me, continues Elizabeth. So I hope this is helpful. It is helpful, Elizabeth. I'll let Chris know. Chris, is it? Says Elizabeth. I'll let you get back to sleep now, Elizabeth, sorry for ringing so late. And I'm grateful for what you've done. And it's cute you keep saying our expert instead of Joyce's daughter. Very loyal. I promise we'll look into it. Thank you, Donna, and no comment. When you're over next, I would like you to meet my friend Penny. Thank you, Elizabeth, I'll look forward to it. Can I ask why you wanted to know what time Tony Curran died? Just idle curiosity. I think Penny will like you very much. Night, night, dear. 38 The morning sun is rising in the Kent sky. I brought him, if you keep driving at 29 miles per hour, this whole exercise will be moot, says Elizabeth, her fingers drumming on the glove box. And if I crash on a sharp bend, the exercise will also be moot, says I brought him, eyes fixed on the road and intending to remain steadfast. Would anyone like a mini cheddar? Asks Joyce. I brought him was tempted, but he liked to have both hands on the wheel at all times. 10 and 2. Ron was the only one of them who had a car, but there had still been an argument about who was going to drive. Joyce hadn't held a license for 30 years and so was out immediately. Ron had put up a token fight, but Ibrahim knew he had lost his confidence on right-hand turns and would be secretly delighted to be voted down. Elizabeth put up more spirited opposition, mentioning that she still held a fully valid tank license. She really could play fast and loose with the Official Secrets Act at times. But, in the end it all came down to this, Ibrahim was the only one who understood how the sat-nav worked. It had been Elizabeth's idea, he was happy to grant her that. They knew, somehow, that Ian Ventham had left Cooper's Chase at exactly 3 p.m. and they knew that Tony Curran had been murdered at 3:32. Ibrahim had had to explain to everyone what a Fitbit was. And so here they were, timing the journey in Ron's Daihatsu. Ibrahim knew they could have just plotted the journey on the sat-nav, but he also knew no one else realized that and he had fancied the drive. It had been a long time. So Ibrahim is behind the wheel. Joyce and Ron are happily sharing their mini cheddars in the back seat. Elizabeth has stopped drumming her fingers and is now texting someone on her phone and everyone had been to the toilet before they left, as per his instructions. Could Ian Ventham have made it from Cooper's Chase to Tony Curran's house in time to kill him? If he couldn't, then they were barking up the wrong tree. They were about to find out. 39 Okay, folks, I'll show you mine if you show me yours. Another early morning and Chris Hudson's murder squad is assembled, in various stages of dishevelment. Chris has brought in Krispy Kremes from the garage and they are doing brisk business. Chris goes through what he'd discovered from the Thursday Murder Club and what Donna had told him about the file, after she'd buzzed on his door at 11 p.m. They'd talked about it over and over and then watched the first episode of Narcos Season 2 with a bottle of red. Donna had invited herself over and Chris had wondered if this was just what constables were like in London these days. You had to hand it to her, she knew how to make a quick impression. Ian Ventham, Tony Curran's business partner, broke some bad news to Curran less than 2 hours before the murder. He was cutting him out of a development that would extend Cooper's Chase, a retirement village out near Roberts Bridge. This would have cost Curran a lot of money, and his death has made Ventham even more money. Over 12 million. The two men were seen having an argument shortly before Curran returned home. Did he threaten Ventham? Did Ventham decide it was better to be safe than sorry and send someone round? We know that Curran was killed at 3:32 last Tuesday, but when did Ventham leave Cooper's Chase that day? Where's this info from? Asks a young Dick, Kate something. Sources, says Chris. Where are we on traffic cameras, Terry? You've got Ventham's reg number. Donna's phone buzzes and she looks down at a message. Good luck at the briefing this morning. Love, Elizabeth X. Donna shakes her head. Got the number, but nothing yet. Still looking, says Terry Hallett, shaven-headed, muscles bulging from underneath a white t-shirt. There's a lot of traffic. It's a fun job. That's why you get donuts, Terry, says Chris. Keep it up. And where are we on our other friend in the photograph, Bobby Tanner? They've talked to the police in Amsterdam, says Kate something. Bobby was working for some scousers there after he did a runner. It didn't end well, as far as we can tell, and no one's heard of him since. No records, no bank details, nothing. We're still asking around, to see if he's come back under a different name, but it was a long time ago, there's not many of the old faces left. It'd be nice to chat to him, rule him out at least. Anyone with anything positive for me? A junior DS puts up her hand. She's been sent over from Brighton and is eating carrot sticks instead of a donut. Yes, DS Grant, says Chris, taking a punt on her name. DS Granger, says DS Granger. So close, thinks Chris. There are too many officers on this team. I've been looking at Tony Curran's phone records. He gets 3 calls on the morning of the murder, all from the same number, doesn't pick them up. A mobile, untraceable, probably a burner. Chris nods. Okay, good work, DS Granger, email me everything you've got and get onto the phone company, in case they can help. I know they won't, but one of these days they will. Of course, sir, says DS Granger and treats herself to a carrot baton. Donna's phone buzzes again. We are having a little Thursday murder club road trip, in case there was anything you wanted to pass on? Okay, gang, let's get back to it. Terry, anything from the traffic cams, let me know straight away. Kate, can I team you up with DS Granger and see what you can learn about the phone calls? And keep tracing Bobby Tanner, wherever he is, alive or dead, someone must know. Anyone who feels they've got nothing to do, come and knock at my door and I'll find something boring for you. One way or another, let's get Ventham. There is a final buzz on Donna's phone. P.S., my sources saw Chris buying donuts this morning. You lucky thing. Also, Joyce says hello XX40 Bernard Cottle finishes the code word puzzle in the express and puts his pen back in the pocket of his jacket. It is beautiful up here this morning. On the bench, on the hill. Too beautiful, a cruel trick, played on those not still here to see it. He had seen Joyce and her friends driving off somewhere this morning. How happy they had looked. But, then, Joyce seems to make everyone happy. Bernard knows he has gone too far inside himself. Knows he is out of reach, even to Joyce. Bernard is not going to be saved and he doesn't deserve to be saved. Still, what he wouldn't give to be in that car right now. Looking out at the view, as Joyce nattered away, perhaps picking the loose thread from the cuff of his jacket. But instead he will stay here, on the hill, where he sits every day, and wait for what's to come.